Hare Rama. Last night, as we all were, I'm sure, the beautiful rainbow that appeared over the gathering, over our space together. And I was glad for all of you who had asked for something obvious. Many of you had vocalized that. You wanted something obvious and clear, so I don't think there could have been a more obvious and clear sign that could be also non-life-threatening. That our time together has been well spent, and I hope you all feel that way. Please forgive us for whatever inconsistencies and discomforts have been there from the side of Goloka Premadham Harmony Collective Community trying to make things work in our simple way. Please forgive us, and thank you for making the big trip. It's a yagya whether you're driving 7 hours or 7 minutes to come into association like this more than once, more than twice, 5-6 times over a weekend, driving back and forth. It's effort. And at least personally, I can say I've felt it very deeply. And the contribution that each of you have brought. Some of you have chided me for being in the kitchen a little too much. And again, forgive me for that also. I was really missing the kirtan, so I'm very happy that I caught even a few minutes now. That's really where my lament was, that I keep having to not be at the beginning and then leave at the end, which is when the kirtan is. And our coming together is really all the discussion and all of the churning and all of the opening is ultimately so that Nam Prabhu can come. And we can invite with seriousness, with earnestness, with honesty, please come. And I haven't been able to spend as much time doing that with you all as I would have liked, so that just now was enough for me to feel closure for our time together. This is our last session, and so that's, in some sense, what we want to create, and we're going to ask Bhakti Rasa, Maharaj, Jai, and Ujjwal to come up and be a sort of panel to guide us in that act of closure. And a piece of imagery I'd like to put forward, and then maybe a possibility also for that for each of us individually. As we shared at the very beginning, the value of a retreat isn't so much in the escape, but in the absorption that allows you to enter back into the so-called normal in a transformed way. And there's a new normal that will come, and there's more retreats that will be needed, but there's a new expression of my existence that I'm now aware of the potential of, and I'm going to go try that out. I'm going to go see what happens, how it happens, with who it happens. Not naive that it's all going to be perfect and sunshine and rainbows from here on out, but there can be some rainbows at least, as we saw last night. And in that hope, the image that I've had for about a day and a half now, on the beach we hear about the ocean of prema, the ocean of love that we're being invited into by Mahaprabhu and his associates. And the coolest part of the ocean for me is the waves. My family knows if there's no waves, I don't want to go to that beach. The waves are where the fun are. But the waves, they push you onto the beach. And the wave that we want to ride is the one that pushes you out into the ocean. Not towards the comfort and safety of land, but towards the unknown and the discomfort of the ocean of prema. And there's a special wave that we get to ride in devotional service. That paradoxical material energy which becomes spiritualized and sends us out into that ocean of love. What wave might that be for you over the course of this weekend? How is that dynamic moved in your life? One way to capture that might be a question that you can leave here with. So often we search for answers, and that's been a big theme of this weekend, how we're struggling with answers, but really what's moved us and made our life worthy in some sense is the questions that we've asked. And so I offer that as something to consider as we hear this final panel, and of course there'll be lots of room for discussion as well after our devotees share. Maybe that's something you would like to leave here with, is a question as a wave to take you out further, not just beyond this space that we've created this weekend, but Tuesday, Wednesday, and beyond. How to move closer to that fathomless, boundless ocean of love that we're promised and invited to by our Guru Jamas. So I'll ask those devotees I mentioned to come and sit at the fore of our circle. And Maharaj graciously indicated that he was open to having the difficult task of going first. So, as just a request for everyone in respect of our DC devotees who have traveled the longest because they traveled by car. Technically, Raj traveled the longest, but he took an airplane. So for our DC folks, we want to be able to close our circle by 12:15 so that we can be having lunch by 12:30. So as we want to make space for sharing, also be considerate of that Kala Danda, that time factor, which is also Krishna nudging us in certain ways. And we'll all look forward to taking our last meal together as well.
Pranam to all, good morning, and thank you so much, Dev Mahaprabhu, for your words, and of course to all of you, all the devotees, local devotees who have hosted and organized this retreat, invited us, and all of you who came from different parts of the country, of the globe, to join us. Thank you so much. I was thinking, as part of the theme, main theme of the retreat, Reclaiming Our Ideals, something that I personally like to do also at the very closure of a meeting is to kind of reclaim, in one sense, remind ourselves of what we went through these days very briefly, like a brief journey of reclaiming our ideals and not forgetting them, bringing them back to memory, and journey of gratitude and appreciation, and then some concluding words in relation to what Deva Madhavaprabhu invited us to in terms of what a retreat means and how to move forward back to the same landscape with renewed eyes, as Jai will put it. So, of course, we started our retreat on Wednesday. Somehow, unofficially, at least in my particular experience, we started for Nisrim Khachaturdasi. Some of us were not there, but both on Nisrim Khachaturdasi and next day, rather Raman appearance day, we talked about the sacredness of matter and how God is immanent and how the divine, as you were saying, begins here. We can start our journey in contact with the immediacy of this world and sacralize our day-to-day experience and how God himself appears from a rock, appears from a pillar to remind us of how ultimately everything is sacred. He's fully present and it is us who may be omni-absent. Mm-hmm. So we somehow, at least for me, was a warming up for what's coming here, since for me it's very important idea that we need to reclaim in our life and tradition how all is sacred, including matter. And then we have our inaugural forum, so to say, panel, where Deva Mahaprabhu started kickstart of the retreat, talking about what's a retreat for, and it's not about further retiring from life and hiding and escaping, but somehow it's a form of confrontation with what we need to be confronted with, truth-telling, intimacy, another way of talking about the same thing, and the importance of somehow disrupting the normal, so we gain new perspective, we gain new eyes. Also, Joy Jagannath Prabhu talked about recovering our spirit of passionate inquiry, and again, going back to the very first time when we joined Bhakti and how was an intensity in our quest, and how we can reignite that, or if that's already ignited, continue putting wood into the fire so the fire continues moving forward. Also, we shared some words about the importance of finding sometimes new language or new words or new expressions or new framings to frame our journey, to frame our existence, to understand what's going on, what we are going through. If we don't have the words to talk about it, we may not have the capacity to see what's taking place. So that's also part of the reclaiming of our ideals. What else? We talk about Sambandha. Jai brought this beautiful structure of the hero's journey from Joseph Campbell. By the way, the very first book I read from the devotees actually was one of Joseph Campbell. He was narrating the Damodar Lila. So he's to blame for quite a while for us being here. Also, we talked about questions and how they a question set us on a quest, as Jai mentioned. We talked about baseball, no? Going from home base and going back home with renewed eyes again. Talked about mystery, talked about individuation, and so on and so forth. Then I had the presentation of surrender, and we tried to reclaim surrender, such a foundational notion as that needs to be addressed without any trauma being triggered in our attempt to embrace surrender, and how we can reframe, recalibrate surrender as self-acceptance, as self-love, as prefaced by awe and wonder, not out of coercion, not out of fear, not out of social pressure, not out of statu quo, but out of wonder. And naturally that surrender will be the healthy foundation for our bhakti temple that we want to construct in our heart. In that context, we talk also about unconditional love and how Krishna already fully accepts us and loves us. And on that foundation, we can learn to accept ourselves. If Krishna accepts me, who am I to not accept myself, basically? We talked about the importance of, again, being present, openness, presence. We just mentioned this idea that we are already saved. And the actual question is, what to do with my salvation now? That's an interesting question that we can leave this place with. What else? We talked about how everything is ever evolving, so it's also not a journey about being here and having to arrive there, and once I'm there, okay, game over. But it's a constant, eternal unfolding, and we are already doing what we want to do for eternity, so there's reason to celebrate our existence. Then we had Jai's sessions, which became started singular but overflowing a plural session two times we met, and he presented this beautiful proposal of what I like to call descent work. Interestingly, we talk about going deeper, but going deeper means going down, but going down means going up. No, mm-hmm. We want to go high means go deeper. Go deeper means go down. So we were integrating these paradoxes into descent work and the spiral journey that the Jai depicted. We talked about midnight sunlight, we talked about midday sunlight as well, and Mr. Go, we learned some new cool terms, at least for my own glossary, and the importance of vulnerability and in sharing our testimony. The ones who were invited to that, that was very moving, and the ones who were holding space by their compassionate witnessing and by receiving our testimony unconditionally, without bias and judgment, all us together were creating this sacred, safe space. So that was an epiphany unto itself. As we were talking yesterday, also we have to, after those experiences, we start to develop this confidence that there has to be transformation. It cannot not happen. If we get together in this spirit, some miracle will happen, including rainbows at the end. And yesterday, in our last session with Ujjwal Prabhu, the main theme was Sankirtan. So also we're trying to reclaim Sankirtan, if you will, redefine Sankirtan, what Sankirtan, going beyond the official one-liners, definitions, and trying to infuse life into the definitions of these important terms, because these terms are our life. No? So we have to be able to talk about them with life infused into them. So it was a very special session, at least for me, as I trust for Vishwal Prabhu, and we talked about also ceremony and the importance of the principle of fire and getting together around sacred space and performative versus transformative and how to inhabit the proper side of the equation. What else? We talked about what satsanga, actual sadhu sangha, and how easy it is to enter into a satsanga. It's not that difficult. How actually the definition of satsanga that Rupa Goswami gives is there has to be affection, there has to be something higher flowing, which for me is there has to be honesty, which allows something higher to flow. Mm. So honesty, affection, and like-mindedness, that's not the ideal recommended sadhusanga. That's sadhusanga.
That's the baseline.
Basically, without it, we have to use another word, and generally the word is asatsanga. So we have to be very carefully not confusing one with the other. What else? We talked a little bit about Rasa Lila and how can we draw some lessons from this beautiful, unique peak of reality in our particular stage. With Jai's question came this important notion of grieving and how to grieve from a place of appreciation and gratitude for something we've lost, but by grieving properly, actually we are reclaiming what we lost in its most essential form. So that's a natural dynamic of pain and love and grieving and celebration. Life moves in these directions. We talk, of course I'm missing lots of things, but we talked a lot about many things, all of them in the context of reclaiming our ideals. And there was laughter, there was tears, there was grief, there was introspection, there was celebration, there was life. That's what's life about, right? Mm-hmm. Getting together to share all the myriad of emotions and experiences in safe space, in sacred circle. So basically what we have been doing is living life as simple as it sounds. Right? Experiencing reality as it is, as we said the other day. Not only Bhagavad Gita should be as it is, no, but everything else. So we basically witnessed the miracle of reality unfolding in its most organic possible way. No? With this foundational patterns of get together, establish a common center, let's constellate around it, and let's witness whatever needs to be witnessed in that particular connection. So as Ujjwal Prabhu was also using this term of rehearsal, we are entering into a rehearsal of how reality looks like in its ideal form. So all these for me are in one sense trailers of the spiritual world, so to say. Someday we want to reach what we call spiritual world, we need to be inhabiting that space in the here and now. It's not that I'm not creating that setting and suddenly I'm thrown there. No? Mm-hmm. Krishna protects us from that. And one thing that also, I'm two things more that come to my mind in terms of reclaiming our ideals was that, in one sense we were talking a lot, not only the meetings, outside of them. And big part for me of reclaiming our ideals is just talking about things. Not like giving ourselves permission to talk about what probably we have not talked ever before or it's not supposed to be talked about, and just give ourselves permission to talk, give ourselves permission to listen to each other, to feel, to experience, to express, to receive the other person. It's empowering. Now, when you give yourself permission and the circle gives yourself permission to be all that you can be, again, that's when we are recovering our tradition, reclaiming our ideals. Deva Madhava introduced the retreat saying, okay, this radical personalism part two. And I was like, okay, I agree, it's okay. Because for me, radical personalism is another way of talking what's Gaudiya Vaishnavism. It means to be radically personal. Be as personal as we can, as a person as we can, to the root, and be willing to together rediscover Gaudiya Vaishnavism. I mean, how think together, feel together, how we can continue being a devotee, choosing to be a devotee, growing to be a devotee, like voluntarily investing myself. I want this. I'm willing to die for this ideal. I mean, so yeah, for me it's radical personalism. How to discover a way to be a Gaudiya Vaishnava that is relevant for me, that is relatable, that is natural, organic, that is irresistible. No? I mean, we are supposed to worship the all irresistible, so whatever is in connection to that person has to be ideally irresistible. So how we create that environment? And one thing that comes to my mind also is reclaiming our ideal. For me, going back to the framing of that, is how sometimes we may need to employ different words or different concepts or different framings that even are coming from other traditions or from other people, and use them to point back to how those things are in our tradition, but we lost sight of them so much that we need to go back to contact other disciplines or traditions, use a particular framing and point back to, oh, it was there in the Bhagavad Gita. No? Like, I don't know, I was talking about surrender prefaced by Paul, and I was quoting Richard Rohr. Right? Or Jai was talking about his presentation referring to Joseph Campbell, and Carl Jung is in the midst of that as well. And Ujjwal was talking about Sankirtan and talking about circle work, which is very present in other native traditions. So for me it was interesting how we on one side we gave ourselves permission to draw from these disciplines, but in the spirit of rediscover our own tradition and realizing, wow, yeah, this is part of my tradition, but how I got lost track of that. I mean, so I needed a new word, a new framing, whether it's hero's journey or the two halves of lives or circle world, you name it, whatever works, but in the spirit of reclaiming our ideals. So for me that also was a very important point to highlight, how we should be open to learn in every possible direction, and how other traditions and disciplines can reflect back to our own tradition and help us to rediscover where we are. And so as Jai was also pointing, we have this journey of departure and initiation and return. Now, like going back home in the baseball dynamic, going back to our respective places, to our same landscape, but hopefully with renewed eyes. And as Deva Mahaprabhu was saying, lots of answers may have come, but also the nature of proper answers is that they ignite new questions also. No? So hopefully we go with answers, but hopefully we go with questions. And maybe some of the questions are like, okay, what to do with this now? What to do with these experiences, with these gifts? How to continue reclaiming my ideals? How to take advantage of this momentum and keeping that in one way or another? So, of course, we have to answer those things for ourselves. Now, what to do in my life, in my circle, with my local people? How to invoke the healing or the medicine that we felt we received? Probably that's one of the main questions. And we may need to stay with the question sometimes. Sometimes you need to stay with the question enough, so gradually the question starts to turn into the answer, so to say, right? Sometimes we want quick answers to the questions, right? We want, again, closure. But sometimes we need to disclosure to keep the door open, and there is a question, and there is a question. Like I was telling you in the beginning, a part of my question is the principle of guidance, receiving, giving guidance, and those who have been with me for the last year, even in Dandavat Parikram in Govardhan or recently in other retreat, still the same question. And it doesn't mean that nothing happened in all those months, but still the question is there. It's a long question. So we may need to stay with some questions for some indefinite period of time, and gradually those questions become the answer, and gradually when the answer comes, further questions are coming. That's how life unfolds. It's the good thing. again, question and answer. So, yeah, for me personally, the experience has been very rewarding, very confirming. Already, I've been fortunate in having momentum with some other retreats and experiences that act as an epiphany and as a confirmation, and is further pounding the post, like, and Krishna making it clear about the importance and necessity of this type of gatherings. And I personally also feel it's kind of the, I don't want to sound like fanatical, but I feel that these types of dynamics are the future of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, so to say, for that to be kept sustainable and relatable in some small gatherings with intimacy. We can invoke proper intimacy, we can connect on a personal level, and there is enough trust and safety to be ourselves. That's absolutely empowering, basically, right? So, and that's for me parampara, ultimately. It's not just like, okay, your name is this and you do that, but it's just like getting connected, getting infused with live wire, plugged into its proper place, and each one goes to their own place and starts to set the world on fire, basically. Your local circle. You are on fire, and naturally that becomes epidemic in a natural way, in a sustainable way. So, yeah, it gives me hope and it gives me inspiration, and I feel blessed and fortunate to be part of that in some way or another. So, I want to thank you, all of you, for being part of that. Again, it's Sankirtan, so we need each other for this to happen. Each one of you is like a crucial piece of the puzzle, so thank you to each one of you.
It's a panel, right?
Yeah.
Wait, what's her name?
That's a question Dick recall.
I thought it's not like Q&A or like realizations, and
you could do that one.
That's what I was thinking. That's how I heard it. How did you hear it?
Originally thought Q&A.
Oh, my God.
Say something.
If I had to take in a car ride back to Harmony Collective, Evan and I were talking about prayer circle light and prayer circle heavy. So over the course of the last 2 days, we had like a prayer circle heavy. Mara and I went to Evan's sound bath yesterday, and it helped a lot because we were both tired. And I was like, actually, honestly, I want to go back to the Harmony Collector from the sound bath and just take rest. I really wanted to just take rest. Because energetically, I feel like the normal way that we give classes is didactic, you know, it's like vertical. Yeah. There's an enlightened speaker, and he's addressing an enlightened audience often in like scripture. But it's like didactic. It's kind of a more masculine structure. Whereas like circle work, where everyone's allowed to just be, is more like feminine work. So I was realizing that it's kind of a good balance to have both. Because feminine work, even over the 2 days we did it, I was just like, I need to recover. Yeah. And I'm feeling like that today also. I was in the car and I was like, I need to recover. And like the thing is about to start. I said, I'll come over. Just now coming. I wanted to stay for some time. Anyway, so that was like prayer circle heavy. And it's important. It's also healing. It's medicinal. But Evan and I were talking about prayer circle light also. And the image that came up for us was growing up, I didn't do it too much at my own house, but growing up, we used to have dinner together. And we would sit in a circle around the dinner table. And, you know, phones weren't allowed. You weren't allowed to sit in front of the TV. It was just the family. And we would just eat together and you discuss, like, your day. And sometimes there would be arguments at the table. And there would be laughter and all sorts of things. And it was like, that was like prayer circle light. It's something that happened every day. It wasn't super intense. It could get intense at times, but it wasn't super intense. And it was usually over a meal. And I was telling Evan that in the spaces that I go to in the future, I would like to do that also. Mm-hmm. So that we have, like, here you guys have started also the Ekadashi ceremony. It's like prayer circle heavy. Mm-hmm. Staying up throughout the night and performing some ceremony. But it would be nice to have, like, prayer circle light, you know? Like a daily interruption to the normal way of being during the day. Pause, come together, share a meal together. And discuss. Anything can come up. Doubts, inspirations, realizations, and so on. So if I had to take something from the retreat, I was taking that in the future spaces I go, I would like to have that dynamic with the people that I share space with. I was in Milwaukee for 2 weeks with a non-devotee. But you know, he was a friend. I met him only in the beginning of the year, January. I was with a pilgrimage with my god sisters, Shamsaki and Shamgopi. I met him there. He said, whenever you come to the Midwest, can you please come and visit me? So I visited him. He was like very well to do. His house was fire. But he could not enjoy the house because he owns a business. He owns like a literal building. I think he sells health insurance or something. And he was constantly working. You know, so he worked throughout. He would leave the house at like maybe 8 o'clock. He would come back at any time of the night. He can come back sometimes 5, sometimes 9, like any time. And when he came back, he would also work oftentimes. And I was just observing over the 2 weeks. I was like, I get to enjoy your house. I was enjoying it, like it was a very nice house, and I was enjoying it. He gave me carte blanche to like do anything in the house, go here, anywhere. And I was like, I'm enjoying the house. You don't get to enjoy it so much. But I was thinking, you know, I had come there. He had hoped to spend time, but we couldn't spend so much time because he was constantly working. And it made me reflect on how the like postmodern world is just such an imposition on just like human existence. And specifically, I was thinking about the fact that you didn't share a meal together. Like, you just didn't, like, that simple act of just sharing a meal and actually just, like, connecting wasn't able to happen because people are working. And so I was just like, what an imposition on just, like, basic human existence. And I was contrasting that with my upbringing in high school. I mean, my best friend, her name was Sarah Rios, one of my best friends, that too. And I was on the chess team with her brother, and her little sister and I shared the same birthday. And there was her mom and dad, and I would go there almost every day. And the dog, Ari. And I was contrasting the two experiences, and how beautiful and wholesome that high school experience was versus like the emptiness of like not even being able to have a personal engagement. So yeah, I guess what I'm taking from the experience here is like I would like to have prayer circle heavy. I've also been inspired by prayer circle heavy, like the sort of imagery of circle work and the sacred fire and kirtan throughout the night. Dancing and all that. And I was like, I would like to have prayer circle light also. That would be like just a daily interruption, you know, that of the normal way of being. A daily one that you can share space. It also reminds me of Rupa Goswami's Six Loving Exchanges, Guhyam Makyati Prichati. You know, Prabhupada commenting on that particular verse says, just by engaging in the Six Loving Exchanges, one can develop Krishna Prema. One will develop the goal of life. So Guhyam Akyati means to divulge secret things, and Guhyam Prichati means to inquire about secret things. So prayer circle light can facilitate that, and then you have prayer circle heavy where there's like a huge heart divulgence that takes place in inquiry into that. Which also what allowed for the North Star one's ideal to shine brightly. You know, home is where the heart's at. We have this sort of cliche there. And like your ideal is kind of where your heart's at. Mm-hmm. But that light can like get dimmed. It gets dimmed by the fast-paced moving existence. It just starts to, its light starts to get dim. Another thing I was always telling my friend, he was like, he would ask me a question, and while I was trying to answer it, he would like do something on his phone and do this and do that. So he was like, Jai, do you have any feedback for me? And I was like, first of all, I was like, I'm scared. Because I don't know how you would take the feedback also. And normally I'm like, no, because I have feedback for myself. So I'm mostly, my conscience is like this. every day. And sometimes, like, can you consider me? My consciousness is like, but I said, okay, you're asking me to consider. I said, maybe you have to slow your pace down a little bit, because your pace makes a different, the pace of life creates a different type of human. And if you need any evidence of that, you can come to New York City. You see, pace is very fast, so it creates a different human. Even I saw with myself, you know, because of fast pace, when I would come to a place like South America or just like normal America that's not in the city, I'm like, why do y'all walk so slow?
I get there.
It's like deeply frustrating, you know? Or, you know, you're like in New York if you're driving a car.
Yeah.
You should start moving before the light turns. Like, it's just about to turn green, the car should be moving. But if you actually wait for the light to turn green and then you, like, pause, it's like, what are you? You know, there's a way to honk the horn where it's like, hey, like a polite, and it's like the, you know, get the F out of the way. So I was just thinking, because the pace is so fast, it creates a, it does something to the character of man, the pace that one moves. Or the way that we receive knowledge, the pace is also too fast. And so we don't allow ourselves time to, like, digest information. It's just like, we know. It's just, actually, it's, if, like, God looking at us like, homeboy looks foolish. The information doesn't have enough time to be digested and assimilated, and the pace is too fast, so your pace creates a different type of spirit. Anyway, so yeah, like the pace of life is causing the ideal to be dimmed, and the pace is only, like, seems to be increasing in speed because of all the technological accoutrements. So the light is becoming dim. But if there was, like, a daily interruption to the pace of existence, just sharing a meal together, I have a doubt about this. What's your doubt? Does Krishna exist? You know, and it's like, yeah, you just hash it out over, like, per circle light. And then maybe it's not resolved in the daily per circle light, so then you have a per circle heavy, where there's, like, a the meaning of other great minds who also think about these things. And then it can be hashed out in such a space more profoundly. And then the light is about to shine brightly. And even though you're in the desert of samsara, your North Star is there, you're still able to navigate very easily. Yeah, relatively easily, because the star is bright. So that's kind of what I got out of the retreat over the course of the experiences. And prayer circle is heavy. Prayer circle heavy is heavy and beautiful for what it is. And I was like, I would like to also do prayer circle light. And just sharing meal and sitting in circle. And yeah. Just as you were saying, just talking, like having a human life, just talking about our ideals, our hopes, our despairs, and how nice it is. One final thing, just in relationship to that, therapy is such a prominent thing in the postmodern world, and oftentimes the therapists themselves are...
I'm friends with some therapists. I'm like,
yeah, I'm friends with a few therapists, devotees also, devotee therapists, they're very nice. One of them is just like, I'm like, bruh, you have no business being a therapist. But then I was thinking, you know, I tend to think, you know, I'm kind of a classic Hare Krishna, like all the fanatic stuff that we were hearing about and how unhealthy it is. You know, that gave me life. And I lived in that. And of course, now the way people see me is like kind of, I think a lot of people who don't know me think of me as like liberal. And I dress a little funny for the ISKCON community, maybe some of my ways. But I'm still kind of like a classic Hare Krishna, and I still have some resonance with that. So I used to just take therapy as a scam, just on principle. Like, I'm a classic Hare Krishna. They're like, who are you voting for? We don't vote. Who am I voting for? Why are you asking me such things? There's like voting between Hiranyakashipu and Ravana, you know? There's classic Hare Krishna's think like this. That's how I think.
Yeah.
Now, if I'm in liberal New York, I try to blend in as much as possible. So I don't know yet. But in my head, I'm thinking
Trump.
I'm not voting.
Just move to D.C.
No, I will say Trump just to cause irritation. if someone is very anti-Trump, then I'll say, I don't know, I'm thinking about Trump. That's just because I have contrarian, like, trickster energy. But actually, I'm a classic Hare Krishna. I think voting is nonsense. We're devoted, but, you know, this hand motion also. You know, you do what it is. Inside, you can't do it outside, but inside, I'm just, what nonsense. So that's how I felt about therapy also. Like, therapy, what a scam, you know? I'm just cheating people. One session, $250. I'm like, homegirl, you need therapy. But I came to appreciate over the last few years, you know, therapy was just like a kind of weak or feeble replacement of this, like, community.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. People before they lived with family and friends and a village, basically. Yeah. And there was always someone to talk to constantly about anything you were going through at any point, despair, happiness. And because postmodern world, we've become so atomized. So now therapy and all these other things can come into the space. And so they're needed because of the atomization of humanity that has taken place. But just like by these simple things, then these things will become redundant. You have like prayer circle light, prayer circle heavy. Yeah. Brought up yesterday what Joe was saying, you have someone that knows your whole life, then things like therapy, et cetera, become redundant because it is already in place. So I was just feeling, that's the space that I've been feeling also just in my own existential, the existential space I exist in now is like being pulled towards that. So that's what I'm taking from this space. Paracircle heavy, paracircle light, and just see the magic that can unfold from having a human existence that reaches for devotion from there.
Well, I want to thank all of you first, to begin with. It's been a beautiful experience for me, and I am so glad I was able to come and to meet and to be with all of you in this sacred space, in these sacred moments. It's what Jai was just talking about, village. It's interesting. I've always valued village life, and when I lived in Dallas, Texas, we were going to be moving to a new place that had just been developed, been bought, was being subdivided, and it was in Sandy Ridge, North Carolina, and they were trying to figure out a name for this place. So my vision of it, we were planning on moving there, my vision of it was of a village. So I actually put forward the name Prabhupada Village, and that's the one that was accepted. But because it's really the village aspect that I really do believe in, multi-generational experiences, and, you know, all different kinds of people living together, helping each other, where one is weak, the other is strong, things like that. Then the second community, I left that community, and another community I tried to develop was Sargrahi, and the model also was a village community where we would have different places on the property, elders, families, brahmachari ashrams, different things like that. So all the varnas were there, all the ashrams were there, and it was meant to be a very holistic thing. Neither of those communities survived in a village vision. I think we need to really redefine what village means this day. And it's not just a division of land and that you have this section here for that kind of people and that section there for these. And, you know, it's this.
Yeah.
It's this. It's the coming together. This is the village part. And, however, that what shape that is going to take in the future, we don't know, but it's taking this shape now, and it seems to be quite successful. This is the village, and it's vitally important. We can't make it alone. Even materially speaking, we can't make it alone. What to speak of spiritually? It's advised in all walks of life. We need each other. We are social entities. We are spiritual entities in relationship alone. We do not even exist by ourselves. So, of course, we're not going to make it by ourselves. Relationship is where everything is. Life is in the relationship. So those places, those communities failed because there actually wasn't this. There wasn't this village. There was land, 140 acres, no problem. But this, in whatever square footage this is,
10 acres.
This is the real, right in here though, this square footage. This is the village.
300 square feet, yeah.
This is village life. This is the coming together of the new, the old, the young, the aspiring, and learning from each other. The elders learning from the up-and-coming people with fresh ideas. And the way your brains work. Oh, I worship the way your brains work. it's so beautiful. I love it. It's, you know, it's like if you give a kid a cell phone, a baby, they know what to do with it. And I'm like, where's the instruction manual? You know, it's like, it just, and I have a friend who's elder, and she's like, oh no, it just does not compute. So it's not just materially that your brains are different ways, but also the consciousness that is able to flood that. It's so beautiful. You are the next, the upcoming, and oh, I'm so hopeful and full of joy seeing you all. And learn from my mistakes, please. Just whatever you want to know, whatever I did wrong, it would take a long time to explain all of it. But please learn from my mistakes. There's no need to repeat them. You'll make your own, for sure. But this is beautiful to me. This is life. This is life. And I appreciate all of you so much for coming and for pouring your heart and for being vulnerable, because that's where it all starts. That was my experience, my lesson this time, was the importance of vulnerability. When I first came here to the community, I've heard about you all. Maharaj has introduced me to you in different ways. And I was so excited to meet all of you when I came, and I'm like, I don't fit in. I know they're very loving, they're very welcoming, but I don't fit in. I feel distant, and it wasn't until I allowed myself to be vulnerable that's where the fitting in was. It wasn't you all didn't change. I changed. I allowed myself to be open. So it's that vulnerability is the beginning of connection. And once I became slightly vulnerable, I felt connected to each and every one of you. And it was a beautiful experience for me, and I'm very glad to be able to carry away the importance of vulnerability. And one last thing is, the topic was reclaiming our ideals. So sometimes we think our ideals are something like Krishna's way out there, up there, something to go for. But our ideals can't be separated from our foundations. And it's the foundational practices. And in Radical Personalism, the last seven chapters highlight particular aspects of devotional life. And these have come to be known as the seven pillars of a sangha that grew out of Radical Personalism called Tadatmya Sangha. So these seven pillars are like foundational things, and they are actually have been, it's nothing new in a way, but they again have been reapproached and rethought of, just like Maharaj's class on surrender. It's like, and I mean, I heard him, he gave a class on the four regulative principles, and you know, who wants to go to a class on the four regulative principles? Like, oh my God, it was dread. But it was part of it. It was like the most beautiful thing. I'm like, oh my God, that's why we do it? Oh, wow. So it's like it's a reapproach to things. Mm-hmm. And it's the foundations which will give rise to our ideals and the ability to live them and to practice them right here in the arena of life. And yeah, it's not about going somewhere. It's not, I'm going to wait till I reach my ideal. It's all foundational. And what we have at the foundation, we build upon that. So, yeah, that's what's coming.
Thank you. Really great to have you here. I get to know you the little bit that I have. And I look forward to many more conversations.
Thank you.
Years ago, when I was in my Christian evangelical phase, I lived in Atlanta, and I was a part of a small group of people that were unhappy with the leadership of the church. And it was a very big church that had been around a very long time, First Baptist Church of Atlanta. And Charles Stanley was the pastor, and his son Andy had a problem with the way his dad was doing things, because his dad started becoming the personality cult instead of it being about God and instead of it being about principles. It became more about him. And he ended up cheating on his wife and doing some things, but he wasn't going to step down. And he didn't have a board of directors, and he didn't have people that he answered to, because he established this church and it was his and he owned it. Needless to say, the son and a few of us who were part of this youth group, we decided we were going to separate from the church. And this was a huge thing, because imagine, like, First Baptist Church of Atlanta was like thousands of people, big organization. And the reason why he started to do this was because he said, we're not reaching people. We're not actually engaging the congregation. It's him up there telling everybody, and it's toxic. And if we're going to start to try to make a change in people's hearts, then we need to create our own group that continues with small groups. So I was a part of this, and we grew from 7 to 70 to 700 to now, I think, over 13,000 members. But the one principle that's still the same, it's North Point Community Church, if anyone is interested. Andy Stanley has a podcast. I can't remember the name of it. I think you mentioned it once, Deva.
Maybe Deep and Wide?
The what?
Deep and Wide.
Deep and Wide.
Deep and Wide, yep, he has one. He also has another one on principles of leadership, which is really good. But he talks in a way that is very... He tries to be non-sectarian. He tries to be connected to God as the principle and less about, you know, the minutiae of the workings of the Bible. Even still, he holds very clear principles about how to grow a community. And the way that he was wanting to grow this community actually worked and is still working to this day, and it was the small groups. I can't tell you how many times I was a part of small group in that church as we grew. And it became like this weekly, I looked forward to it. It was a family dinner. We showed up, we sang, we ate together, we shared together, we cried together, and then we went on our way. But throughout the week, when things would come up, we had an opportunity to reach out to this very small group of people that we felt very connected to and loved by and upheld by, and it was such a beautiful thing. And since leaving that place, I have missed it dearly, just this aspect of it. So it really is enlivening and exciting to hear you talk about it, because one of the things I've always been fascinated by was communes and groupings of people that live together, work together, like are side by side in their experiences, you know. Oh, she's having a baby, let's all get together and help her get the house ready. Or she's had the baby, let's all get together and serve Sri and the baby and Ananda. And it's just, this community definitely has that loosely. Like, there is the one thing that I've expressed recently to Ajwala and Dave Madhavan, that that I do feel sometimes very lonely. That I do sometimes feel, even in the love that this community has, and I know there's so many people that have reached out to me and said, I love you, and, you know, you're important to me. But I still feel very lonely sometimes, because I'm missing that team of people to live life shoulder to shoulder that engages with me and says, hey, you said you were going to do this, did you do it? Or, hey, you know, I noticed you were a little bit antsy today or short. Are you doing all right? How's your sadhana? How's your internal talk going? So it's exciting to hear you talk about the way things haven't worked and how you're recognizing now in hindsight that this, the core of the communication of the community, is really what gives life. And you know, in the Christian sense, they say that the church is not a building. And truly, I don't think that bhakti is a building either. I think that it is an emotion that's felt of love between the individuals, part of it. So, thank you for being here, all of you, and it's really wonderful.
Can you sing something? There are so many different things to say, and I appreciate everything that the three of you said, and also what you added, Brooke. I'm really moved by the idea of reconstructing the village. I think my own vulnerable self really needs that. And really needs that connection, has been drifting for much of my life, and wanting that, and I can feel that resonate in your description, Brooke. And I liked, Jai, I liked what you said about prayer light, prayer circle light, and the way I'm envisioning it, the way it's coming to me, is that prayer circle light will be proof that prayer circle heavy is actually underway. Because in some paradoxical fashion, though prayer circle light is light, it's very hard to reconstruct. And I'm thinking about, as you were saying, Bhakti Rasa, that communities ultimately fail because people aren't able to come together and share their hearts. And it's just really difficult. And I think especially with religious expectation on top, as beautiful as a religious tradition is, it just heaps this level of expectation and performance that stops people from saying, whoa, this isn't working for me, because they're afraid that, whoa, I'll be kicked off the table if I were to say that. So I'm really moved by that, but it brings me to this kind of paradoxical thinking that they do both have to go on at the same time. And I think about, you've been saying this verse, Guhyam Akyati Prichiti, that these are the six, actually, that make Krishna consciousness move. And thinking about the other four, didati pratigrinati bhunkte bhojayati chaiva, I like bhunkte bhojayati chaiva, feeding, eating and feeding. You know, it's like, let's break bread. Let's sit and let's just try to set down the phones and set down everything and set down our schedules, at least with the people closest to us, and actually share a meal together. And you think about, like, what does it mean to give a gift? Like, to give a gift, there's the I'll just use our terminology, the karmakanda way of saying, okay, this will make my bhakti go forward. I'm going to give gifts to devotees. You know, and I think we've all seen a version of that. Like, oh, what's the right day to do it? And, you know, I should give something that's like meaningful. And it's like, this is what a devotee would like. But such a sweet thing. Like, the verse is really calling for the depth of humanity. Like, feed people, give gifts, you know. When somebody gives you a gift, thinks about you, sees you, like, receive the gift, you know? And I just think that is such hard work, actually. And it's fitting that it's in the nectar of instruction, the Upadeshamrita. It's like in the very core of it. We think the core is like, okay, Radhakund, and go to Vrindavan, and, you know, do extremely serious spiritual practice. But I think that this verse is really a core of it. Like, be a human with the people that are walking the path next to you. Because there's not many of them. You know, if we do it on a percentage basis on the planet, like, we're really lucky to be in a room like this. And so, Yeah, I'm just so happy to be here. I think this is the most amazing thing that I've experienced in many ways. It's very affirming to me that a bunch of people who, we basically went into this blind. Like I said, Deva, Maharaj, and myself kind of birthed the structure of this in a yurt in Arkansas. And it wasn't going to be this. Like, it wasn't like, all right, we're going to do circle work with people. It was very much going to be at least semi-didactic but conversational way of talking about terms like surrender and love, you know? And so the fact that this just popped out, I mean, yeah, this is the thing. This is the work, and it's really beautiful. And I just thank you all for bringing your hearts and taking part and allowing yourself to be affected by it, allowing yourself to be moved by it. And the last thing I really feel compelled to say is a reiteration of what Deva said, because it's a principle that has affected me deeply in the way I look at things like this, is let's not let this be a compartmentalized experience that we walk away from. Particularly, let's not, when it's over, let's not say, ah, that was intense. You know, oh, I'm so glad that, like, I'm going to go back to normal, and that was beautiful, and I'll talk about it and tell people about what I did. Let's not walk away from it. It's like everything is for the next door, basically. This all set us up for a next experience. And there is if you were moved deeply by what has happened here in the last couple days, there's another deeply moving experience just around the corner waiting. And so let's, like, summon the warrior in us, in a good way, not in a way, but let's summon the warrior in us, walk away from this with your chin up, even though you're exhausted, and ready for the next time to be transformed, because it'll be right there, especially if you were deeply moved. If you were deeply moved, which I think most of us were, then there's some surprise to help integrate whatever we've gotten in this pause, in this sacred disruption. As Maharaj says, there's a beautiful opportunity for each of us to integrate that. So I would just beg all of you, please search for that. And don't let the coals grow cold. If they do grow cold, it's not the end of the world, because you know where to go. Look for people who are real around you. And if anything, look for these people and see what they're doing. And see if you can come back and say, hey, well, I lost it. You know, can I get relit? You know, but let's try to hold it. Let's try to hold it. Let's carry it forward. And just thank you all for being here and holding the space.
I have one thing to add to that. Maharaj had said at different times that these ceremonies, and like when we observe each other's birthdays or special holidays and festivals, those are simply reminders as to how it should be every day. Mm. So coming together in the ceremony, what we experienced here is a condensed reminder of what is available and what we can make happen for each other and for ourselves every day.
The beautiful thing is, if we get into a rhythm of it, I think it'll actually be even more. Like, the magic isn't actually in the retreat, so to speak.
That's it. Keep it here.
We can also pass this thing.
That's it. Yeah. I have faith that, like, we'll be blown away. We'll be blown away by having an actual consistent connection with the people around us. And with God through those people. And yeah.
So my question, I have a question. Thank you all so much for this weekend. Honestly, it's like affirmed so much. It's like, I know I already had like a flame going, but it's just like more and more wood on the fire. And I'm feeling really inspired, you know, to like continue my journey of like studying and actually marrying the feelings and the feeling through bhakti with the learning of bhakti, right? Mm-hmm. And starting to pair those together. One thing that I've been thinking about though, since last night, somebody over here, they're not here today, you know, they were talking about, like, the war in Gaza and all of these, like, suffering, you know, that's happening. And something I'm acutely aware of, because I think my freshness and newness of just learning about it, is that, like, we're in Kali Yuga, the age of forgetfulness, the age of, like, separation and strife, you know, this really intense period. And I think I worry sometimes that I just, like, I'm like, well, it's Kali Yuga, this is supposed to happen, so let me just like let that happen, and then I'm just going to do my own thing. But then I worry that that's spiritual bypassing for the suffering of all of the jivas who are like in this war in the world and things like that. So I guess like the ideal that I'm trying to sort of like hash out within myself is like, how much of this do I just say, well, it's Kali Yuga, you know? And there is something comforting in that, right? Okay, this is supposed to happen. We're supposed to be separate. We're supposed to be in strife, you know? Like, we're supposed to be, like, not remembering our connection with each other and with divinity and with Krishna, you know? And it's, like, fortunate for me that, like, all I have to do is just chant, you know? And then that's, like, that's the salvation in this period. But that, you know, to me is kind of, like, I struggle, you know, because, like, how much do I care and how much do I really, like, invest and involve with this struggle, but then also realize, okay, this is Kali Yuga, so it's supposed to be really intense and, like, this is supposed to happen. Does that make sense? And so I guess I would love, like, some insight on how I can, like, formulate this ideal that's, like, I don't know, balanced and not so spiritually bypassed, but also not so consumed by Kali Yuga that I forget that I'm in Kali Yuga and I'm just like, wow, everything sucks and this is awful and this is how it will always be, but actually it's only going to be like this for 415,000 years.
Just wait it out, you know?
So I kind of like, I've been going back and forth between this and it kind of makes me feel like, whoa, I think I need to be caring a little bit more, you know, about like these huge things that are happening, but also like, who am I and what can I actually do from like over where I am, you know? I'm not going to fly on a plane to like Gaza and like be on the front lines of like support and help. I mean, I could do that, you know, like if I really felt inspired. So I don't know. This is like, these are like things that I'm trying to like reconcile in a healthy and conscious way.
Can I go first?
Yeah. I also have something I'd like to say after.
Have something. As someone who lived in New York, this was coming up a lot always in the Sangha of Devotees. The
social justice.
Yeah, social justice, the accusation of spiritual bypassing. And so it made me contemplative about the topic because I'm kind of a classic Hare Krishna. So I'm one of those persons who will say it's Kali Yuga. You know?
Yeah.
Hare Krishna. That was my tendency, but because I was always in the face of devotees who were social justice activists and who were often accuse our community of spiritual bypassing and maybe contemplative about the subject matter. I just think on a fundamental scale, dismissing human suffering for any reason is extremely dangerous. Mm-hmm. Like also just personally, mm-hmm. and because it translates, because we're not separate from one another. There's a lot I could go into, but just to keep it somewhat simple and summarize, the image that I have, I use this word a lot, is like mycelium. Mm-hmm. You know, our bodies are like the fruiting bodies mm-hmm. of a more subtle realm that's more interconnected, mm-hmm. like mycelial threads. So the building and then the bodies and the harmonium, these are like fruiting bodies of this more interconnected world. Mm-hmm. So to harm or to dismiss the suffering of someone else is almost to dismiss your own suffering. It translates, like, psychically. Mm-hmm. And so you'll discover, we have discovered in our community, devotees where we don't know, like I was saying, don't know how to grieve our own suffering, don't know how to relate to our own suffering. And it may have an element of that dismissal of this human suffering in general. So that's something to be, you know, thoughtful about as a general principle, like fundamentally speaking. At the same time, on the other side of this is that I think one can only be compassionate about Gaza and the other things that are happening in the world proportioned to the degree of care around the people around you. Because another thing that I've observed in communities is that concern about the greater world is an excuse to neglect what's happening interpersonally. Because that's right in your face and it's confronting.
Exactly.
And it's also a mirror. So you don't want to look, you know, I was talking about this with Casey yesterday. I was like, oftentimes we have demons inside that we don't want to face. So we project them onto some other person and fight with the other person mm-hmm. because that's easier than facing ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so when you're in a community, like it's super intense. If you have a partner and they're always in your grill, so then it's like, you know what? Gaza. And it becomes another way of bypassing something that's very human. So one has to be thoughtful about that. And I often, when I would have these sorts of conversations in New York, that would be my complaint about the accusation of spiritual bypassing. That, well, you're bypassing the responsibility that you have to your community. I haven't seen you. You haven't asked. You're accusing me of something, but you haven't asked me where I'm at. Mm. I also have my own suffering that I have to engage with on a moment-to-moment basis. And they can say, well, your suffering isn't what's happening in Gaza. I'm like, baby, yes, it is for me. Because I don't get to experience my suffering objectively. I'm always the subject of my suffering, you know? And so even if it's relatively small from like a third party looking in, for me on a subjective level, it's humongous. And Viktor Frankl in Masters for Me, it's a book that I cherish a lot. I like to reread it every day. He gives an analogy of gas entering a chamber and filling the chamber up uniformly. He says, so whether the gas, the chamber is small or big, the gas will enter and fill it uniformly. So when any suffering enters the psyche, relatively big or small, it fills it uniformly. So he says there's no use in measuring people's suffering because they don't get to be the, they don't get to experience their suffering objectively. So like trying to compare like that isn't, it isn't fair. So you're telling me I'm not, you're giving me the accusation of spiritual bypassing the suffering, but you haven't even asked me where I'm going through or what's happening with, that's making me spiritual bypass. So on the other side, there's the risk that you're leveraging the world's issues to not have to face yourself, to not have to face your community. So that's on the other side that one has to be careful about. The care should at least be proportionate to that. That was the main point. I have another thing, but these are, I think these are the two main things, you know. Yes, we should be careful about dismissing because we're all interconnected. At the same time, we have to be, oh, the last one I want to make is this, that we're finite entities. And we weren't meant to bear the world's suffering. Paramatma has a mind that can bear the world's suffering. A finite jiva doesn't have the capacity. So the technology has actually created a very unnatural psychological situation for us. You know, where you're going, where you're almost, it's almost like the postmodern responsibility is to like bear the full weight of what's happening.
Like everywhere in the world.
Everywhere in the world, all the time. Yeah. Like I remember when
you don't even know your neighbor's name.
You don't even
know. Right. Exactly. You're so exhausted. You don't want to.
Yeah.
You're terrified of your
tell
neighbor's
me who's
name.
Up for election in Turkey.
Right.
Like what their stance is on policies and all that jazz. Yeah.
So
and
it's
that's
unnatural.
An informed citizen. It's like such a delusional escapist paradigm.
Right.
Yeah. Peddle, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, Fox, whichever one you like, they're all peddling that same delusional escapism.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I remember when this Gaza, specifically the Gaza thing broke out, I have a lot of friends who are Jewish, and so they were very passionate on one side and had friends who were passionate on the other side. And the friends, they would come, I'm like, baby, I don't want to hear about it. I don't. I'm going to watch dog pictures now. They're like, but you're that's bypassed. I'm going to see dog walks. I'm going to see the cute dogs. They are really emotionally sensitive. And it's like, I see them like smile. And I feel touched all the time, you know. I'm looking at dog photos. You're like, but this is, I can't bear it.
Yeah.
I'm already having a hard time bear my own existence. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm, you know, thankfully because I have trickster energy, I'm happy-go-lucky, but I despair a lot. It's tethered by my happy-go-luckiness nature, but I despair a lot. I don't get suicidal, but I despair a lot. And now you're saying, Gaza. Baby, no. I can't do it. I can't do it. That would just be psychologically demoralizing. I'll just be on the street just like, just give me drugs. You know? And I'll just... Yeah. So that's the third thing. We have to be considerate about our finitude.
Yeah,
we have to be considerate about our finitude and how much what sort of compassionate output. This is a personal critique I have of the Hare Krishna movement as well. That we're so concerned about saving the entire world. I'm like, let's consider this one important just theological fact: the jivas are unlimited. Unlimited, not just like, you know, if you pick up a grain of like a handful of sand, we'll say it's innumerable, but it's still finite. It could be counted technically. But the jivas are not like that. The jivas are literally unlimited. And all the jivas that are now existing, that's only a certain amount that's released into the cosmos. And if one jiva gets liberated, it will be immediately replaced by another jiva who is in sleeping state inside Mahavishnu. This is just a technical point. Point is, the universe is always going to be filled with someone that's going to be needing saving. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I'm also interested in saving the jivas, but I'm going to start with...
I do. Mask on before you put someone else on.
Period. I want to save this jiva because I'm despairing. I'm not connected to God. I'm not communing. And I probably will make a situation worse before I made it better. Mm-hmm. So I'm not bypassing the world's grief. I'm trying not to do that. But I'm also being considerate of my finitude and seeing that the world that Krishna has me existing in real time. Mm-hmm. And I have to honor that work that's there in real time.
Yeah.
And if that work is honored, then there might be a possibility to extend a little bit more mm-hmm. with consideration of our finitude. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we would be devastated. Only Paramatma has the capacity to hold the world grief and not be affected by it. I see one bad reel or something. I saw one bad video in the gossip thing in the very outset, and I shared it on my story because I didn't have any wisdom. Immediately, I was like, all right. I was like, should I block them? Just for my peace. After that, I was like, that's it, dog videos.
Yeah.
So I wanted to respond to that because it was a huge contemplation for me in New York because I was constantly getting berated for spiritual bypass because I'm like a little bit of a classic Hare Krishna in my thinking. So it did make me contemplative about it, and these are the result of 5 years of thinking about this particular thing.
We're right at noon.
Okay.
As an alert to the... Okay.
Want to say something as well?
I mean, you said it so nicely. Pretty much covered all the points. I just, to reiterate, because I really feel it, my feeling around the way the world is and how technologically warped we become is that we just fall into the trap of the misdirection of what's actually in front of us. Mm-hmm. Like, what's in front of me is the people in my life that I could care about. And you said it also at the end, like, that may grow into something very big, but the only way that that'll actually grow into some big lasting change that I can know is substantial is if I engage in it right now. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of lament for the fact that so many people are, and that I have, as a Hare Krishna as well, with the idea of save the world at some point, fallen into the trap of thinking that big change is something that I could affect. It's kind of like it's just kind of a problem of warped ego, which we just see in this world. Like, oh, the only thing that I should take part in is something that's going to be huge. And then actually what happens is we just get utilized unconsciously for something that we have no idea what the outcome is. We have no idea. We don't even know if it's true, to be honest, on either side. We just don't know. We're being filtered something through our phones, through the garbled telephone versions of what other people are saying. The only thing I really know is my own suffering and the suffering of the people closest to me. And I personally have deep faith. We haven't gotten to go into it here as much because we did a very extemporaneous, spontaneous circle work. But by doing, there's a verse, Yatatur Mula Nishechanena, and this verse is utilized in the most spiritual bypassy way possible. But if you pay attention to Krishna, everything else will be worked out. But I genuinely believe that if we intentionally come together, do the village thing, and worship the center, worship God, then that will heal us, and that will give the foundation for that to grow in whatever degree it's supposed to. And that's, I don't believe in change that will happen any other way. Because I think everybody else, if we zoom out far enough, is stuck in an ego battle, warring with each other, killing each other, fighting, using very good things, just as we have with our own tradition, to hurt each other. You know, and taking the best thing and used it as an axe. So the job, really, I think, is to sit down and sing together and recognize that God's in the center and let all of these things really integrate. And I think it's small work. And we have to be okay with small work. I have to be okay with small work. Because I have no way to fix Gaza or Russia and Ukraine. I have no way to even know where to start. And if you're a little honest and you try to start thinking about that stuff, it's just like, oh my God. This guy's saying this and this guy's saying this. And I arbitrarily pick a side.
Yeah.
Usually because of my social circle that's really impassioned about something. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
then it defaults to the only thing you can do is just share about it, you know, like post and share and make a thing, and it's like, okay, but like,
what's that doing?
Not doing anything. If anything, it's just like promoting the messages of where I'm getting it and trapping me into finding things to share about it, and then it's just doom, 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 and gloom, you know?
And that's the big misdirect, right? Because then we're just existing in this virtual hell that we know nothing good is going to happen there. And yet, that's what we're told, like, this is the forefront of the battle. And if you don't pour all of your energy into that, you are not helped. Like, you're bypassing, and you're just like, no, my best friend, my village, my people, like, I need to be there for them. I am finite, and compassion fatigue is real. And then what's the result? I just shut off. I just shut off. And the drugs are in my pocket.
Who made it our responsibility to save anyone anyway? I mean, this is something I've been asking a long time, even in all the religions that I've been a part of, which has been many. Who made it our responsibility to save anyone? We're merely here to water the seed. We can plant it, we can water it, we can weed around it, we can facilitate sunlight, but it's not our responsibility to save, nurture, and grow that seed from beginning to end. And it's this warped, I think, view of our power, you know, inherent, that really screws up this ability that we have to do something meaningful by doing the small work. Because who knows who watered that plant today or tomorrow or the next day? It doesn't matter. We're helping by watering that plant. We're helping by weeding around that plant person to facilitate some love. It's our responsibility to facilitate some love, but also by loving ourselves. If we make it our responsibility to save any individual, we're already placing ourselves in the position of God, I think.
That, to speak to a kind of principle about this question, because Gaza or my life trauma or any spectrum in between, from micro to macro, this saved attitude, it kind of presumes an order of operations about how to make things good. And anyone that's ever engaged with the a priori offered order of operations knows they're pretty bad, right? They're based on assumptions and prejudices, and they fail you individually, and they fail the people that are trying to help collectively. So we're on this land right now, and I can remember in 2017, there was this push in our community, we need a farm, that's what Prabhupada said, and cows, and vegetables, and self-sufficient. And I was just like, inside of me, I instinctively felt, no, that's not what Prabhupada wants us to do. And we came with this mantra, families before farms. Farms are the fruiting body of a mycelial network of families. You get that resource once your relationships are in order. So whatever realm you feel concerned with and feel to go and change, first question your order of operations and the prejudices and the circumstances, the modes that have pushed on you some conditioned idea, and with your best conscious effort and the closest people you can trust, actually come to a recognition of what's the work truly. Because ordinarily it's not the sexy stuff that people want to hang their hat on. It's the hard stuff that everyone's been avoiding, that no one will see the fruit of for years, generations. That's what we ought to be doing. Grief, you don't get awards for grief. There's no BBT newsletter for grief. And that's why it's going to avoid it for 50 years. And if we do it again for another 50 years, we won't have a movement in the sense that we like to. So question the order of operations of whatever work and whatever realm you feel yourself called to.
You know, I just want to add another thing, that don't forget, in the middle of his comment last night, his important part was saying that he felt a sense of community that was missing. He was talking about the people sharing, providing food to each other. He was mentioning things that were apart from the struggle. He was actually reflecting on his sense of community that he felt in that network of people. And so I heard the complaints and I heard the other things, but in the middle there was this need for family that he was actually talking about, and how he felt that they're stronger than he did in religious networks. And that's what I related to. It's like, okay, we can choose to pick sides, but I think what he's really talking about is a sense of community.
I just really want to say a little bit different. Trust. These circles And vulnerability, like you were saying, which comes first is a question in my sense of taking home. When there's been pain, either in communities and breakdown of communities due to breaking of trust, confidentiality, judgments, but rebuilding and how we take responsibility to act to initiate the seed of trust, as well as how do we trust? Because it's a reciprocal thing. It's not just I've got to trust. Well, what is the fertile ground that will bear trust? Like when I go back to Bhakti, it's like, how do I create a fertile ground where people feel they can trust? Mm. But then, vice versa, how do I enter trusting? Even like you said, there is a trusting community, but how do I enter vulnerability? But even that word has, to some degree, it has mystery. And what you were saying about the pace of life. Now, D.C. is like New York. Mm. Everyone, like my good friend that you brought up, he's like, yeah, those D.C. people, they walk with sticks up their asses. They're all lawyers, lobby. I mean, they're like really fast-paced. They're not your New Yorkers, but they are like, they're like, it's the pace. There's certain, and I'm contemplating, and I hope my colleagues here will, you know, how do we create that fertile ground of softening to create trust, but then knowing the people that are coming in, or people that are part of that pace, even it's a bit of a pandemic, even it filtrates to the whole DMV and the community spread around. It's not this beautiful farm area or out in the Midwest, and it's just different when you're out here. It's like, it's that pace, right? But that trust is something that's a reciprocal thing, and what vulnerability looks like for someone in Washington, D.C., very, very different. And it doesn't have what does vulnerability mean in different circumstances and trust to bring someone into that as well as to trust. I would be curious of a little sharing of any kind of insight that you might have, if there is a 5-minute, you know, little window there. Not sure if there is, but
now the window's for you guys in DC, so we have time if you're asking the question.
We have time. Oh, we have windows.
You're the ones who are not to hold.
We got the window. And I do want to say, you know, I'm so grateful for these beautiful souls coming with me, and Ethan is, he needs to be really on fire because he manages the studio. I'm stepping down. This fire is like burning solo for a little while. This one has to be contagious more.
Teresa?
All right.
Evan, you have something connection to what she said?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I mean, yeah.
They only have 7 minutes.
Okay. well, I've spent a lot of time with Tamal, who, like, I think a lot of this circle dynamic has, in my life at least, and I know has inspired a lot of people in this room also, in that way. Kind of reviving that dynamic. I remember, he's a revolutionary person. I have a lot of faith in the fact that he can, I know a lot of people that have a lot of faith in him and how he can have a lot of change, catalyze a lot of change on a big level. But it took a while for me to understand and other people to understand, like, that's actually not what he wants. And understanding why that's actually correct thing. So my friend said to him when he met him, I hope you get a soapbox and a megaphone. And Tamal said, that's the opposite of my approach. I want to, like, be in a closed door. I want to make, my change is going to be behind closed doors on the individual level, on a small scale level. And yeah, I just have a lot more faith in that approach. He says, like, the healing for the collective is found in the healing of the individual, yeah, and the healing of the individual is found in the healing of the collective. Yeah. And just that whole, like, polarity of true achintya bheda bheda tattva, dualism and non-dualism, like the perfect non-dualism, which is neither dual nor non-dual, that in and of itself, dualism. But, yeah, it's another thing about Tamal is we were doing a lot of circle work in Colombia, and he, it was heavy, so we had to take a little break and we watched a movie. It was just me, myself, and him. We watched his son's favorite movie, which is Raya and the Last Dragon. It's so beautiful.
Such
and it's
beautiful.
Their symbol is like the circle, and it's all about trust and like how it takes one person to really like be bold enough to trust. And our trust in, you know, I think a lot of the dynamic about what came out in the circle the past 2 days was like how our trust has been, our faculty for trust has been like calcified and bruised through, you know, such deep ideals, important ideals, great endeavors for spiritual enlightenment and spiritual bliss. And then trusting a community that says you're, and trusting gurus that you think are going to provide that for you. And then you just become, you know, utterly, existentially let down, and then to rediscover that dynamic with people, I don't know, it's kind of like, almost kind of feels like trauma bonding, but I'm not really sure with it. Yeah, I have a lot of faith in that small group dynamic, and I hope that people do sit around the fire and the dinner table. And that's the way that I feel like we can help Gaza, honestly. It's just coming together. And,
yeah. Let's do a Harinam in Gaza.
I'm going to pass on that one. I know.
So to address what you were saying, Gopi, also your direct question is, to begin with, it's about creating safe space. That's the very beginning, to create a sacred space and to hold that space yourself so others can feel that this is a safe space.
Yeah.
And so as soon as somebody walks in, wow, safe space, I can be myself here. And any conversation begins with listening. Mm. So to create a safe space where people can be heard.
Mm. And inclusive. Inclusivity is huge. There's a lot of people can be heard if you choose to hear them. But why do we not choose to hear someone?
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as they walk in by the appearance, we make an unconscious bias.
Mm.
And that's painful when I see that happening.
Yeah.
It's like, why are we doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not safe, even just by our unconscious biases, because then we're not really listening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not safe, and it's not inclusive.
Yeah, good point.
So I do feel that very much. But yeah.
And then to be willing to be vulnerable yourself in a safe space, you know, to emulate that and to show that. And that takes a bit of trust. It's like we were talking about, one of my favorite things is to interact with wild animals.
Mm.
Like, we have raccoons. We have raccoons that come, and my favorite thing is to feed them.
You should walk up the road and interact with that big dog.
Yeah. Wilder animals than that. Ones that haven't been filtered by, you know, contaminated by that human thing. But, you know, because it's complete exchange of trust.
Mm.
I am fully trusting this creature that just walked out of the woods, who is quite capable of inflicting harm, I'm utterly trusting him. And he, in turn, has to utterly trust me.
Mm.
Wow. So, and I can watch this raccoon. He's considering it. He's checking me out. He's like, you know, what's going to happen? And, like, he checks his escape routes mm-hmm. also. Can I get away if this doesn't work out? But he inches closer and closer, and I just hold, you know, perfectly still and invite this. And he knows. So, and eventually, there's, like, the reach, and still pause, and then takes it. And in the beginning, takes it and runs. But then it didn't end there. That was just the beginning. But it's an exchange of mutual trust, which to me is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Personally, that's, and I love that.
And now they come every afternoon.
And evening.
They come every afternoon.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's beautiful.
So it's
find raccoons in the city.
But yes.
And even by her going through that process, I don't know. I come first time seeing the raccoon, they don't know me. Mm. But somehow they have entered into the circle of trust and they come and they take from my hand immediately.
Wow.
So my point is it begins with someone that creates that powerful enough to make the person open and feel immediately the process with others as well. So,
Deva Madhava took us to the Metro Park that's nearby.
We were telling her about that.
Yeah, it's incredible. Mm. You guys should go.
The birds.
See, like, you guys already talked about it then and I wasn't here.
In the car.
Oh, in the car, okay. So there's this park.
No spoiler, be careful.
The man.
He may take us on Monday.
Oh. It's not a spoiler at all. You may just want to go.
Okay.
And I now bought a season pass because I love to go and I love to do this. But he, over, I think it was 30-some years, his goal was to create an environment where the wild birds would come and land on your hand and eat from your hand. And he did this every day for 30 years. And now the birds in that whole forest have this trust that anyone standing there holding out a palm of bird seed is trustworthy.
Yeah.
And
see,
will
that's
come and
gossip.
Land on their hand.
Yeah.
And on a micro cut, yeah.
Yeah.
On a micro, yeah.
The thing
but now 30 years later, the man's long gone,
yeah.
But the legacy they left behind of that.
And all those other
trust.
Birds have gone, but they're
exactly.
Families.
There's not the same birds, for sure. So now, how do they know? They weren't trained by the original guy 30 years ago.
Mm.
But it's now this inclusive behavior in this place. The mycelium have communicated this. So it's really beautiful.
Humans are not in tune.
Let me know when you go, because I want to go too.
Yeah. Considering our Washington devotees,
thank you.
Time to...
We are ready.
So we can conclude here. Thank you so much to all of you. Sadhu Sangha ki. Pancha Kalpata Rupa. Pancha Kalpata Rupa.